Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the famous green activist Dave Foreman. Well, Dave, it's great you and I are talking about this with a few hundred thousand comfortable folks listening on radios and iPhones. But the reality on the ground in Africa and Asia, it doesn't give a damn about us. People in the West, where the current population is aging or maybe heading for decline, if you don't count immigration, we just don't see it that African countries are young and they're doubling their population within a lifetime. Maybe we'll get another billion people in China and India. Can we do anything that matters on the international scale?
Well, I think we can, and one thing is to get back to family planning. Family planning just sort of lost its cachet, and part of the reason was the opposition of the Catholic Church to abortion, which became opposition to any kind of family planning, or even pretending that there was a population problem. It also was possibly caused by the feminist movement, where instead of supporting a woman's right to family planning, they switched to support a woman's right to have as many children as she wanted. And so, in many ways, family planning also became politically incorrect. And I think those of us who love the wild world and love quality of life need to get back together with the family planning movement. I wish Gates and other wealthy folks were putting their money into family planning. I think any aid that goes to countries in Africa or Asia for health care should be tied to family planning. I would like to see every woman in Africa have access to family planning in such a way that her thug of a boyfriend or husband doesn't even have to know about it. Because right now, many women want to have fewer children, but are forced into having more children by the man in their lives. We've seen some countries like Thailand successfully control its population through family planning, whereas the Philippines, that originally had the same population as Thailand, is going through the roof because of the opposition of the Catholic Church to family planning. We saw China take a rather extreme step of limiting births to one per family, and China says that without having done that, there would be 500 million more people in China, half a billion. Whereas India, that was not able to get any kind of handle on family planning or population stabilization, is shooting through the skies and is going to pass China as the most populous country in the world. But if we look at the estimates coming out of the United Nations, they're just outlandish. If folks are old enough to remember when Ethiopia had a famine in the 1980s, they had 40 million people. Today, they're up to something like 76 million people. By 2050, they're supposed to be over 150 million people. How on earth is that possible? It's just not possible. And it's going to lead to the terrible suffering and development defects in millions of children. And so do-gooders need to think a little more about what their do-gooding is due, because in many cases, I think it leads to more people suffering more horribly in the future.
Well, Dave, I suffer from a kind of population denial that I think is common enough. We doubt that these new swarms of humans will really arrive because some catastrophe will stop it. Maybe a new plague or nuclear war will save us from ourselves. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that's inevitable. I don't think Ethiopia in any way can get to 150 million people. I don't think Nigeria and Africa in any way can get to 350 million. I don't see how the Philippines can support 150 million people. It's just not going to happen, and it's going to be very awful. People are going to suffer, and we are going to see the suffering and the misery on television. And it's going to be a plague. It's going to be starvation. Climate change is one of the things that is sort of the joker in the deck as far as world agriculture goes. The loss of water, the whole green revolution, was built on fossil fuels, fertilizer, and energy to pump water or build dams. right now in India, 150 million people, are dependent on one aquifer for irrigation, and that aquifer is just about to go dry. And so what happens to 150 million people then? We're going to be seeing things like this, worse famines and other crises than we've ever seen. And it's because the world as a whole, and particularly the comfortable nations like Canada and the United States, would not take responsibility or forethought to deal with these problems.
And, of course, we don't have to look to Africa for that. Look at the drought that's happening in the United States, right in the best crop-growing regions, and even where you live, you were saying.
Well, yeah. And I live in New Mexico, which is pretty low rainfall here where I live. In Albuquerque, we average about 10 inches a year. But last year, we only got 5 inches. And that is creating a real problem. But if we have in the U.S. Great Plains, the Canadian Great Plains, the greatest wheat and soybean and corn growing region in the world, suffering from drought and excess heat, which leads to a real collapse in the amount of food available for export to hungry countries, what are the ramifications of that? And I think we're going to see more of that because we refuse to believe in global climate change or climate weirding, as I'd rather call it, and the strange things that are going to happen. We just aren't being responsible. We aren't looking to the future, and we are going to pay the cost of that. And unfortunately, the people who are probably going to pay the cost first are the poor people of the rest of the world. But then who is really paying the cost is all the other earthlings, the non-humans out there that we always forget about when we talk about overpopulation or climate change. And we are right now causing a mass extinction unlike anything seen since the dinosaurs became extinct from a meteor or asteroid hitting Earth.
Well, that's huge, and I know that people just talk about humans and forget about the other species as though they don't have a right to be here, and we do believe they do. I wanted to ask you, too, about Europe. Like, there is a problem. This has been politicized, and the people that are talking about immigration and population to some degree in Europe are the far right to some degree, and you may have some Republican listeners who agree with you about controlling immigration in the United States. How do you feel about that politicization of what is really just a basic fact of life here on Earth?
Well, it is, though I think, you know, frankly, and this is probably going to upset some people, it's not something I really talk about, but I think in Europe there truly is a social problem, where in many European countries now, it's illegal to say anything that might insult somebody else's religion. I think, thank God, in the United States, we have a Bill of Rights and freedom of speech. There are countries in Europe talking about letting Sharia Islamic law be established in parts of their country. Why is it that every other culture in the world has the right to advance itself and be proud of itself and stand up for it, whereas European culture somehow is not supposed to do that? Why does Europe need to become this sort of place for Islamic takeover? I think there's a real problem there, and it's unfortunate that so many people refuse to look at it and that it has become the province of right-wing sort of nativist type of political parties in Europe, because it's a much bigger issue than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's always hard to see around the next bend in the road, but I'm wondering, what are you working on, Dave Foreman? Where do you see yourself going?
Well, I'm 66 years old. I just had neck surgery, which was a great success, and I've been pretty well crippled and unable to backpack or anything for 10 years, and I feel better now than I have in 10 years. And I plan to be in better shape at 70 than I was at 55. And so I'm going to be doing a lot more canoeing in the Canadian and the Alaskan Arctic, where I love to be chased by musk oxen and that sort of thing. And I'm going to be giving a lot more talks, traveling around. I'm working on several other books right now. And the key thing I want to do is try to get people to pay attention to the real issues. And I also want to encourage conservationists to stay strong, to recognize that our number one task is protected areas, that we need more national parks, biosphere reserves, wildlife refuges, and that sort of thing, particularly in Canada, which right now holds some of the greatest biodiversity in the world, but seems to have a third world mentality about exploiting natural resources, whether it's tar sands or boreal forests or building dams in Quebec or more diamond mines in Northwest Territories or what have you. Canadians really need to stand up, because Canada right now is a treasure of the entire world. And Canada, which has this wonderful reputation as a progressive, civilized country, is engaging in some of the most uncivilized 19th century resource exploitation we see in the world today.
Oh, I know, I know. We've got to move right now to make Vancouver the biggest coal port in North America. Oh boy, we're going to be number one in climate killing. Well, as we wrap up, Dave Foreman, do you have a website, a blog, or a Facebook page to recommend for people who want to find out about you?
My little nonprofit organization, the Rewilding Institute, can be found at rewilding.org. And there you can see my various books that we offer. You can see where I'm going to be speaking in the future. I'd love to come back and give talks in Canada. I've been to Vancouver, Edmonton, Calgary, Winnipeg, Toronto, places like that, and I'd like to do more if Canada would let me in after the nasty things I've just said.
Well, I hope so, and I'm hoping the United States lets me back in after many of the things that I've said. Our guest is Dave Foreman. He co-founded Earth First. He's a lifetime advocate for the wild, a contributor to the new population book Life on the Brink, and author of Man Swarm, The Killing of Wildlife. Keep in touch with Dave at rewilding.org. Thank you, Dave. It's been good to finally talk with you.
Oh, it's great to talk to you, and I'll be happy to be on your program any other time.
Thank you. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock, where we investigate local production, handcrafted living, and the natural. So why am I considering a home made in a factory? Why did Christine Todd Whitman, former director of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, she's a person with all kinds of options and a sense of local history, why did she choose a prefab house? Can I interest you in a home with very low fuel bills in the future? We've got a good guide to growing trends in green construction. She is Sherry Coons, author of many books. Her latest is titled Prefabulous and Almost Off the Grid. Sherry, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you. It's nice to talk with you.
You too. Well, why don't we start with this? What is a prefab home?
Okay, that's a question actually that is asked by a lot of people because they have a lot of misconceptions about what prefab actually is. There are a lot of different types of prefab construction, and in general, prefab construction means that either part or the entire house is built in a factory. So that can include something as complete as a modular, which is made like a box and is shipped to the site and connected with either several or many other boxes, or it can be something like a panelized house or a prefabricated concrete insulated house. There's lots of different kind of options.
But we're not talking about trailers or mobile homes.
Well, mobile homes and trailers are, although those are prefabricated, those are built to a different code. Those are built to HUD code standards. They are different. They are built on a metal chassis, and they are shipped on wheels, and those wheels never come off. And they are not built to universal standards of construction. So, as I said, they're built to a HUD code, which is a lesser type of code. So although those serve a wonderful purpose, those are not the kind of houses that I cover in my books.
All right. Now, why are so many designers and green architects themselves going with prefab construction?
Because there are so many advantages to building with prefab construction. It takes a much shorter time to build with prefab. In some cases, it saves money. It's built in a protected environment, so the materials are protected and they're not out in the elements getting warped and where they could later on become moldy or twist and turn or check. And they're built by professionals that are watching every piece that's being built, and they're being checked by supervisors, et cetera. So there are just so many reasons. And from an environmental standpoint, the pieces that are being cut off are being stored and used again. When materials are shipped to a factory, they're shipped in bulk so that you're not having individual shipments going over the road. There, many of the materials, such as metal and drywall, are being recycled. So there's a lot of reasons on so many different ends why prefab is better.
Well, to get a feel for this, could you describe for us Christine Todd Whitman's modular home in Old Wick, New Jersey? What does it look like and what does it feel like inside?
Well, the most important thing I think that you need to consider about prefab is that they're indistinguishable from site-built houses. So if you saw this house, you would never say, oh, that's a modular house. The Whitman's house is a beautiful house. It has old-world charm. It looks like it's been there for 100 years, but it has all the modern technology that keeps the house functioning very, very well and very efficiently. So it's a very warm, comfortable house, and it's quite beautiful inside. I don't always get to see all the houses in my books, but this particular one, I did go on the photo shoot, and it's quite a lovely house and in a beautiful setting.
And what sort of green tech did the former EPA head implement in her new home?
Well, the house is built with what they call advanced framing techniques, so that there is no air infiltration. They have all Energy Star windows and appliances, lighting, ceiling fans. There's even a metal roofing. They use insulated prefabricated concrete foundation, which is very environmentally friendly and also very good from an insulation point of view. They have a tankless hot water heater and programmable thermostats and whole house energy monitoring systems and spray foam insulation. The house was situated on the property so that it was passive solar orientation. And there was just other materials that were used. They used bamboo flooring and cork flooring, which are environmentally friendly, and low-flow shower heads and faucets. There's a very long list, and actually I have all of these kinds of lists in my book that include all the green aspects and the energy aspects of each house.
Right. I found those lists very helpful, and I found some new technologies there that I wouldn't have known about except for the book. And I noticed that these houses are not just energy efficient. Many of the builders in your new book work to make healthy homes as well. How do they do that?
To start off with, I'm very selective in the houses that I put in this book, and so I am very careful not to just pick houses that are energy efficient but that are environmentally friendly from a material point of view and also a healthy point of view. There's one house in my book that was a person that had very substantial health allergy issues, and so they were very careful, as most of the other houses are as well, to use non-toxic materials, even in the decorating, things that did not have allergens and VOCs, et cetera. They have a very substantial filtration system. So there's a lot of things that people can do. As a matter of fact, I was told, I'm not sure if this is true in Canada, but in the United States, in order to get a mattress that does not have a chemical that prevents fire, you need a doctor's note, which she actually did. And so I did a little sidebar about this kind of mattress acquisition. So there's also, in the book, I guess you noticed, I have a lot of sidebars explaining a lot of the different aspects, so that even if somebody doesn't want to build a prefab house, they can learn a lot about home construction, and they can also learn about materials that they might need to build a healthy and efficient house. And the other thing that people, I think, find useful about the book is the resource list at the back of the book, which will tell you where you can acquire many of these materials and also find the architects and the builders who can build these types of houses.
Well, I think the other thing about these houses, they're built so tight, so air circulation is really important. How is fresh air getting into these homes? And also, could you tell us, what is an HRV, I think it's called?
A heat recovery ventilator?
Mm-hmm.
For me, that's almost magic. I am not very mechanical myself, but I'm totally fascinated by how these work. What they do is, it's a ventilation system that will take the stale air from the inside of your house and exchange it with the fresh outside air. But the really special thing that these do is that they'll exchange the heat and the cool, so that if you've spent money heating your house, it's not going to go out with the ventilation system. It's going to be exchanged with the fresh air.
I'm Alex Smith saying, as we head into a crisis of energy, economy, and the environment, we need alternative voices more than ever. Please support your local nonprofit station. This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking about the book Prefabulous and Almost Off the Grid with award-winning author Sherry Coons. Sherry, when I hear Almost Off the Grid, I picture the woods or the deep desert. But some of your homes, they're located right in Chicago. How do your builders get past those old-style building codes? Well, talk to us about that C3 prefab in Chicago.
The reason that I called the book Almost Off the Grid is because what's important today is that we build houses that are very, very energy efficient. And instead of trying to figure out how to get energy, the idea is to build a house that requires less energy. And so there are houses that are off the grid, and that works very well in certain locations. But the optimal situation is for a house to be on the grid, be creating some energy and giving back energy to the grid when it's not being used, and to be able to get energy when it's needed. And so there are many places in this country, and I'm not quite sure about how it works in Canada, where they have net metering, so that if you're returning energy back to the grid, your meter is going back and you're being credited for the energy that you give back.
But I think some people say, well, you just can't put a prefab here. The building codes don't allow it. But they did. It took a lot of work, but they broke the ground in Chicago and got that prefab in.
That was an unusual situation, actually, because most places in this country, there's absolutely no problem putting a prefabricated house. But in Chicago, it was the unions that were really against having prefab brought in. But the builder was and the architect were just very tenacious about meeting every code and crossing all their T's and dotting all their I's, and they were able to get the house built. I think it came out great, and it was a great prototype for what can be done in Chicago.
I know we have to retrofit a lot of what we have. We can't build everything new, but I do think we have to replace some of our housing. It's like we're all driving clunker cars that get 8 miles to the gallon when there are hybrids out there. So talk to us a little bit about infilling cities with greener homes.
Actually, all of my books, I have found houses that are being built in infill lots. And what's happening is that there are areas in many cities, St. Louis and even in Chicago, that are considered the wrong side of the tracks. Actually, there's one in Seattle as well. And the property was bought very inexpensively because it was not one of the top areas in town, but perhaps very convenient to work and to theater and playgrounds and things like that. And so people bought this property at a reasonable price and put up really wonderful houses and are actually helping to change the area and make it more upscale and make it a place where younger people can start moving in with families and urban renewal. These are really great things. And some of these houses that have been built are quite beautiful, and they did not cost a lot of money. I think that there's a thought on people's minds that if you're building a custom house, it has to be very expensive, or if you're building a very efficient house, it has to be very costly. And that's not necessarily the truth, because as you, I'm sure, noticed in this book, there's a Habitat the Humanities house that meets the passive code, and it's extremely energy efficient, and it was built at a very reasonable cost.
How did you get Robert Redford to write the intro for your book?
Robert Redford is, to me, the most important environmentalist we have in this country, and maybe one of the more important ones we have in the world. And it was my wish to find somebody that was a real environmentalist, not just somebody that was talking about it. And when I approached him to do this, he really liked what I was doing, and so he graciously accepted the opportunity to write the foreword for me. And he is just, not only a great actor and a great director, but he is just a wonderful human being and an incredible environmentalist. He's a man that walks the walk and talks the talk. I mean, he spends a lot of his own money to protect the environment, to save buildings from being demolished, from saving land from being overdeveloped. And he does this without any personal gain himself. So I have just the greatest respect for Robert Redford.
Fancy technology aside, one of the key concepts I got from your book is the important role of using just what nature offers. Could you talk to us about passive solar orientation and things like designing windows and spaces for natural ventilation?
One of the most important things is that the house be situated in a way that you are getting the optimal solar energy in the house. And what a lot of the houses are doing today is they're putting smaller or fewer windows on the north side of the house where they could lose energy and where they're not getting solar gain. And they'll put larger windows on the southern side of the house so that they can get more solar energy and more light. And the other thing that a lot of houses have large overhangs so that particularly in our hemisphere, where the sun is very high in the summer, it will block out the sun from getting into the house, whereas in the winter when the sun is very low, you can get the sun even with the overhang, so you can take advantage of the solar energy. So there are a lot of techniques that people are using today to take advantage of solar energy and make the house just naturally more efficient. The other thing, of course, is advanced framing, where they are framing today so that there is no place for the air to infiltrate through. And so the ideal situation is to build a house where you need less energy. And actually, the house that you mentioned earlier that was built on the Whitman farm, that house has no solar panels and yet requires very minimal energy because the house was built so well and the orientation, the windows, the overhangs, etc., that house requires minimal energy.
Well, for people who want to follow up more, do you have a website, a blog, or a Facebook page you'd like to tell us about?
Yes, I do have a Facebook page, Prefabulous and Almost Off the Grid, and I also have my own website, which is sherrykunis.com, and I guess my books are just about the best resource people can find if they want to find out about prefab and also energy efficiency construction.
So I've mispronounced your name all the way through the interview, and it's spelled K-O-O-N-E-S, is that
right.
Correct?
That's right, and it's Sherry Kunis.
Okay, Sherry, thank you so much. You've been listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Sherry Kunis. We've been talking about houses that live lightly on the earth in her beautiful new book, Prefabulous and Almost Off the Grid. Find links to all that in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for joining us, Sherry.
Thank you, Alex.
That's all the time we have. Remember to support Radio EcoShock at our website, ecoshock.org. Tune in next week, and thank you for listening.